Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mr. Obama in New York, Goldman Sachs on the hot seat, and the virtues of plain speaking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. It is April 22nd today. President Obama went straight at him, took a trip to New York City today to talk financial reform. The audience at Cooper Union in Manhattan this morning had more than its fair share of bankers in it. Still, the president didn't mince too many words.
Our markets are only free when there are basic safeguards that prevent abuse, that check excesses, that ensure that it is more profitable to play by the rules than to game the system.
The president is making one last push as the Senate prepares to vote on its overhaul package next week. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson was at the speech today. He says momentum does appear to be on the president's side.
Those of us inside the auditorium couldn't help but notice Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein sitting just a few yards from President Obama. The fraud charges against Goldman last week are credited with giving an extra push for the financial regulation package that had been languishing in the Senate. As the president spoke of the need for an agency to protect consumers, he pointed in Blankfein's direction and said this.
And unless your business model depends on bilking people, there's little to fear from these new rules. So
it was unclear if the president realized where he had pointed his finger, but a stone-faced Blankfein sure did. Outside the auditorium, even those who didn't watch the speech knew about the charges against Goldman. Risa Glassman says she supports the president's call for greater control of Wall Street.
They had too much freedom and didn't police themselves, and the laws that they had obviously weren't working, or we wouldn't have been in the straits that we've been in.
It's opinions like that from ordinary Americans that are giving the president the momentum he needs to pass financial reform.
It's looking pretty clear to me now that the bill will pass relatively quickly.
That's Kevin Hassett. He's the director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank.
The financial firms are so unpopular with Americans and with politicians that it's just very, very hard to stand up and fight a bill, even if the bill itself has a lot of policy errors in it.
It was just over 2 years ago that then-Senator Obama spoke of the need for Wall Street reform here at Cooper Union. And the president seems to think it may be no more than 2 weeks or so before we know if today's address was history in the making or just another speech. With the president at Cooper Union in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You have to believe there were a couple of thoughts running through Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein's head during the president's speech today. One was probably, hey, why are you pointing at me? Shady things were happening all over Wall Street 2 years ago. Another one was probably, okay, Goldman did nothing wrong. That's my line. I'm sticking to it. But really, should we fight this fraud charge or not? Outside Mr. Blankfein's head, shareholders have a definite opinion on that one, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
James Stewart is a columnist for Smart Money magazine. He also used to be a Goldman shareholder.
My advice to Goldman Sachs would be to settle.
He says investors already lost confidence when the suit was filed. The firm's stock price has dropped more than 10% since then. Nell Minow is with the Corporate Library. The firm researches businesses and their governance. She says a prolonged court battle could bring out devastating internal emails and reveal the way Goldman treats clients.
Because of the way Wall Street guys are, there will be emails there saying we really put one over on them, we really killed them this time. That will be very embarrassing for them.
Minow says Goldman needs to do everything it can to improve its image among shareholders, clients, and the American public, or else
it would be like the last scene in Frankenstein. The villagers would be out there with the pitchforks and the torches.
Get him alive if you can, but get him!
Nell Minow says the SEC also has an interest in settling the case because they don't have the resources for a long court battle. Others say Goldman has to be careful if it does settle. Eric Talley teaches law at the University of California, Berkeley.
The more important thing that's going to be at the negotiation table is what is the SEC going to be requiring Goldman to cop to?
Because future cases could be built upon the things Goldman admits to or doesn't. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Spring was in the air last month, at least if you're in the real estate business. The National Association of Realtors reported today that existing home sales rose in March. With some juicy tax credits about to expire, though, this may be the last good news the housing market gets for a while. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
There's an $8,000 tax credit dangling out there for first-time homebuyers and $6,500 if you're trading up, but you have to sign the contract by next Friday.
I am actually in the middle of helping some buyers, and we are against that April 30th deadline.
Broker Carmen Ryan in Portland, Oregon, says she's been very busy, especially with first-time homebuyers.
This current uptick in sales is definitely driven by the tax credit. The tax credit does give an artificial bubble, somewhat.
A bubble that will start to leak once the credits for homebuyers expire, says economist Patrick Newport at IHS Global Insight.
I think what the housing market needs going forward is a good economy and mostly job growth and not these tax credits that mostly just shift sales from one period to another, but don't elevate the level of sales all that much.
Newport says home prices also need to hit rock bottom before buyers jump in bigger numbers. And that may take a while. There are still millions of homes in foreclosure or headed that way. They'll all hit the market sooner or later.
There's a big glut of homes out there for sale, and in order to get rid of those homes, prices probably have to drop, we think, another 5%.
That's something would-be home buyers like Lonnie Wentworth are keeping in mind. Wentworth is 33. He has a good job as a nurse in San Antonio, Texas, and a growing family.
I mean, we don't want to rush into things, and we've just been taking it easy.
Wentworth says he and his wife have been looking, and the tax credit made them look harder, but they've decided to wait for a better deal. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Traders clawed their way back into positive territory today, and believe you me, it was a long climb. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We interrupt this regularly scheduled broadcast for a story that we thought we'd seen the last of weeks ago. European statisticians said this morning that the Greek budget deficit is even worse than expected. Kind of amazing, really, that that could be the case, because everybody thought it was pretty bad to begin with. In fact, it was fuzzy accounting that set off the whole Greek debt crisis in the first place. The announcement from Brussels this morning sent both the euro and European stock markets south. Moody's downgraded Greek debt again. And Greek negotiators are still trying to work out a rescue package with their fellow Eurozone members and the International Monetary Fund. We asked Brett Neely to figure the odds of this Greek tragedy becoming an American one.
Greece has a serious credibility problem, says Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
It's basically that the Greek government seems to say, oh, well, it doesn't matter that we're going to have a little bit higher deficit. But of course, markets are saying, well, actually, it matters a lot because it means you have even less credibility than you had before.
He says Greece's worsening deficit numbers could mean it will have to ask for even more than the estimated $60 billion it already said it needs. Having swallowed that number, other Eurozone governments may not be able to stomach an even larger bailout package.
The cardinal rule of bailouts is that you do not come back and ask for more. You do it once and that's it.
Europe's biggest economy, Germany, is key to a successful bailout. But many Germans feel that Greek politicians have been fiscally irresponsible. Domenico Lombardi is a former IMF official in Washington and now works for the Brookings Institution. He says if Greece is allowed to go under,
there's a risk that the Greek crisis is going to spread to other countries of the euro area.
The U.S. won't be safe either. Europe is our largest trading partner. The Peterson Institute's Kierkegaard says if the crisis spreads, say goodbye to President Obama's goal of doubling American exports within the next 5 years.
If you have another systemic banking crisis in Europe, that kind of growth is simply not going to be there, and therefore U.S. export growth is not going to be a realistic option.
The worsening crisis has already pushed the euro to a new low against the dollar this year. That makes our goods more expensive for Europeans, which is bad news for many American companies. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is one of the more obscure dates in American corporate history. Obscure, but what you might call a learning moment. April 23rd, 1985. Coca-Cola changes the formula of the most successful soft drink ever and comes out with New Coke. It was so bad and consumer reaction so negative that Coke backpedaled as fast as it could, reintroduced what was called for a while Coke Classic, and launched a whole ad campaign to get customers back. Anybody remember Max Headroom?
And when you first tried Coke, I bet you said, uh-uh, not for me. But hey, let's not let first impressions sweat, and let's try Coke again, shall we? Because once you've acquired that new wave taste, you're going to want to try it again, again, and again.
Like Max Headroom, New Coke has faded mercifully into obscurity as one of the biggest product launch disasters ever. But we've called John Craven to talk about the bad old days of New Coke and how things have changed over the past 25 years. He's the founder and president of BevNet.com. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Did you ever drink New Coke, by the way? Did you ever try it?
Of course.
What'd you think?
I don't remember it being a positive experience. So.
New Coke was, I think it's fair to say, a disaster. Is there any chance that corporate America has not learned its lesson and that we might see something like this again?
No, I don't think we'll see something like that again. I think that people aren't drinking as much cola as they used to domestically. So I think in that sense, the need to go and mess with those products, I mean, they're just... You know, changing the flavor a little bit's not going to make people drink cola again.
Is it easier now to launch new products? I mean, back then it was, you know, you had to do this whole rebranding thing. And now you just sort of, instead of Cheerios, you have Honey Nut Cheerios and Cinnamon Cheerios. And you just do these brand extensions, right?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, from a technical point of view, it's probably easier just because manufacturing is much better than it was back then. But I think, you know, making an impact with one of those brands is much harder just because there's so much noise out there. Even, you know, the choice of mediums to market them, there's just too many. I mean, back in the days of maybe TV and print, I think things seemed a little simpler to some of these companies.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, you can go to some beverage stores now and find, just to pull another cola name out of the hat, you can find Tab. Right, which was a very distinctive taste back in the 70s and 80s. How come there's not that niche market for those New Coke people who really loved it?
You know, look, I mean, cola is very much a part of American culture still. I think there's always a consumer out there who wants to try something a little better. For example, there'd been Mexican Coke a few years back, this sort of gray market imported Coca-Cola made with cane sugar, and that had a cult following. There's people who are out there looking for Passover Coke, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think most people want that mainstream, cheap, readily available product.
Thing is, though, you know, people who like Coke, and people who like Pepsi. So how come when New Coke was rolled out, those Coke loyalists, right, who wore, you know, red and white T-shirts because they love Coke so much, how come they didn't stick with the New Coke?
I think just because they changed what part of what brought them to the brand, which was actually they changed two things. They changed the look of it and they changed the flavor of it. And I think when you remove or change both of those things, you have something that I think for the Coke loyalist was, you know, it was no longer Coke. So I think they might as well have been drinking Pepsi at that point, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and really, consumers don't have loyalties nowadays anyway, do they?
I think nowadays it's more about trying, you know, what's new or hip at that given moment. You know, you can't just go out and build cool intentionally anymore. So, you know, right now in the beverage business, we've got a ton of small brands, but there isn't one that is the breakout of the year. So I think it is definitely getting harder.
John Craven, he's the president of BevNet.com. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, how goes the war against jargon?
Oh, well, we have a lot of work left to do. You only need to open your mail and you know how we're doing.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 9 points today. We'll call that basically flat percentage-wise. Second day in a row that's happened. Finished at 11,134. The NASDAQ gained 14 points, a half percent, closed at 2519. The S&P 500 inched up 2 points, a quarter percent, ended the day at 1208. I ought to mention here the major indices started the day down about 1.4% apiece. Investors do continue to worry if Greece could ever be able to pay back its debt, but sales of existing homes jumped last month in this country, so hey, all's good. That built up confidence. Homebuilder stock as well. Pulte and KB Home climbed more than 6%. D.R. Horton nailed a 5.5% gain. Toll Brothers rose 3.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note bumped up to 3.77% today, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by MassMutual, offering a financial literacy program to help families navigate their finances. Details at massmutual.com/family finances. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for the month of March. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Investigations looks at the causes and consequences of the financial crisis. Tomorrow's hearing will focus on the role of credit rating agencies. And social workers are gathered on Capitol Hill for a two-day meeting to discuss the next generation of industry professionals. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A new law in the United Kingdom gives a nod to that country's colonial past. There are more than 2 million British citizens of Indian extraction. They and all Britons are protected from discrimination based on race, gender, sexual orientation, and now their place in the rigid hierarchy of the Indian caste system. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Thank you for joining us this evening to celebrate Ambedkar Jayanti.
At a ceremony in London, the Indian High Commissioner pays tribute to a revered Indian statesman.
It is difficult to describe in a few words the greatness of Baba Sahib Ambedkar.
Baba Sahib Ambedkar was the chief architect of the Indian Constitution. He was also an untouchable and spent his life fighting against the caste system. The constitution he drafted 60 years ago outlawed caste discrimination, and yet today the untouchables or Dalits are still persecuted, and not just in India. Meena Varma, who's campaigned for a ban on caste discrimination in Britain.
It might not be the same horrific abuses that you get in Asia, but it is discrimination on every level of employment and provision of goods and services.
One victim has been Davinder Prasad. He's a Dalit who's lived in the UK for 30 years. He was managing a department in a large defence company, but caste made his job impossible.
I had two guys who were from higher caste joining my department, and when they found that I was from a low caste, things started going absolutely haywire. They refused to take instructions, and it was a big, fiasco.
Davinder was eventually moved to another department. He launched a campaign group called Caste Watch UK and has dealt with scores of similar cases.
A professional who lost his job in a law firm. We had a manager who was managing a community centre. He lost a job as the manager. So we got all kinds of examples where people are really suffering in their lives because of caste discrimination.
The system can have a really pernicious effect on the young. Take 29-year-old Anita. She wouldn't reveal her last name because of the stigma of being a Dalit. She was born in the English Midlands and only became aware of her caste when she was at high school. Taunted by her classmates, she quickly lost her self-esteem.
I made all these conclusions about myself that I'm not going to be like others because I'm an untouchable, I'm a low caste.
She has prospered and now with her partner owns 3 grocery stores, but she admits that often in the past she concealed her origins from Asian colleagues and customers.
I internalised that and thought, well, I must be really low if I have to hide it. And I think that's what really affected me.
Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami.
At the ceremony celebrating Baba Sahib Ambedkar, people joined in a Buddhist prayer, many of the Dalits perhaps quietly giving thanks for Britain's new equality law. But no one from the Indian High Commission was prepared to comment on it. The Indian government has denounced the legislation as muddled and meddling. Campaigner Meena Varma.
They've always rejected any international pressure on the basis that this is an internal issue that they will deal with. Well, it evidently isn't an internal issue anymore.
Meena and others hope the new British law will be activated soon and will send a powerful message back to India that caste discrimination, like racism, should never be tolerated. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Somewhere in our marketing materials, I think Marketplace is described as being business news for the rest of us. We explain what are often complicated business stories in ways that are hopefully easy to understand. Unfortunately, a lot of the communications we get in everyday life, whether it's news stories or letters from your bank or a new government program, are hopelessly confusing. Anybody who's ever tried to read their health or car insurance policies knows what I'm talking about. There is, though, an organization dedicated to fixing that. It's called the Center for Plain Language, and they are hosting their first awards for the use of good and also not-so-good language next week. Director Annetta Cheek is with us in advance. Annetta, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the Center for Plain Language. How did you guys get things started?
Well, it started with a group of mostly federal employees who were trying to get the government to write more clearly and realized that we couldn't do everything we wanted to do from our positions within the government. So we formed a nonprofit organization with a few private sector folks. And our goal is to get government and business to communicate more clearly with citizens and customers.
How's it going so far?
Oh, well, we have a lot of work left to do. You only need to open your mail and you know how we're doing.
Who are the worst offenders, would you say, in the world of corporate America? Who does it the worst?
I think the finance industry. Every time you get a letter from your bank, particularly, we all got letters recently about the effects of recent legislation on what interest rates they were going to be charging you, and they were pretty impenetrable.
Yeah, not only is the print fine, but you can't understand it once you get your magnifying glass out, right?
Exactly. And some of that, unfortunately, is intentional.
And basically what happens is we don't read this fine print, and then we're financial losers.
Absolutely. In this recent contest that our center ran, one of the entries for what we call the Wonder Mark, which means we wondered what on earth they were thinking about when they wrote that, was the end user agreement for a very popular consumer communication product.
Hold on, I have to stop you here. A consumer communication product? Come on, you're doing your own complex language.
It was a BlackBerry. There we go. All right. If you read it carefully, you would see that it said, these are our policies today, but we might change our policies tomorrow. And when you say that you agree to this policy, you're agreeing not only to the policies that we wrote today, which you can't read, but to any policy that we might write in the future. And by the way, we aren't going to tell you about those new policies. You have to come back to our website and read this agreement periodically so you know what you agreed to.
Now, we pride ourselves on this program of being able to speak relatively plain English when we're handed things like, synthetic CDOs to decipher and to explain to the listening public. We sent you some samples of our writing. How'd we do?
Well, your stories were pretty good. And the first one you sent me was very good.
Remind us what that one was.
It was about
controlling the value of currency.
Yeah. All right. So let me, I'll just so folks know what we're talking about, I will read you the actual introduction to that story that I wrote. So here goes. It was me and I was setting up a story on currency trading, and here we go.
Right.
One country trying to control the value of its currency is really nothing new. So you object to the word really right there.
Well, yes. I don't have a really strong objection to it.
Yeah.
But yes, you don't really need it. But normally I find interviews like this to be in pretty good shape. And so you asked me to comment on this, and I was looking for things that could have made it a little bit better. And that was one thing I found. A little further down, you used the word nefarious, which is one of my favorite words. But I might not have used it in a story on the radio, in print, where people could look it up if they needed to, fine.
So as you get set to hand out these awards, what do you hope to gain by this? I mean, you'll get some publicity, you'll do an event at the National Press Club, and then probably everybody's going to go back to being as confusing as we were.
I'm sure. But we know there's no magic bullet. We're trying to get the public to pay a little more attention to this and to object. I think the public just accepts this kind of stuff because they don't think anything else is possible. And of course, something else is possible.
Dr. Annetta Cheek from the Center for Plain Language in Washington. Dr. Cheek, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
We've got some examples of complicated language made clear on our website. You can add your own, too, of course. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, we have been talking a lot on the broadcast this week about derivatives and how the new reform bill is going to fix the tricky multi-trillion dollar market in them, which is why we might do well to remember the Onion Futures Act of 1958. It's the only time futures trading in a commodity has been banned in this country. You still can't trade onion futures here. Congress back in 58 gave in to the onion lobby. It said speculators in onion futures were making prices too volatile. Of course, what has happened over the past 50 years is that onion prices have been more dynamic than most other commodities, not less. And that is not to say that derivatives shouldn't be regulated. It's just that you never do know what the markets are going to do. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 9 points. Second day in a row, it's not worth really mentioning percentage-wise what happened. The NASDAQ added 14 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 plumped up 2 points. That's about 0.25% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, Wall Street hums a new tune.
When you write and you put on a show, essentially you're asking people to come into a room and believe that something that is not real is real. And that's sort of how financial instruments operate in a way.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.